Very good. Nice to see you again. Sorry for last week. I really wasn't able to talk. It probably happened the first time in my life that I really couldn't talk. The first time I canceled the class because of my voice, and may have been the first time in my career here that I canceled the class. I'm feeling much better. I can talk much better. So today, the topic of today's meeting is how to identify a good research question. Some of the meetings that we have, I'm sure that you have other sources of information, like how to present, how to write a research paper. But this is one where you will not find a lot of information about anywhere else. The only way you can learn this stuff is by talking to your advisor and observing other people, maybe reading things. So I was very lucky in being exposed to a talk like this by one of my mentors, one of my advisors. And I listened to this talk that he gave probably 3, maybe 4 times, and every time I enjoyed it, and I made notes, and I learned something. So, how to find the research question? Here's where we are. We have talked about what is research, how science works, identifying good research problems. It is really critical for success, and in the beginning, the stage of development where you are, your advisor will help you. The advisor will tell you, you already applied for your PhD studies. There is an area that you applied to. Within that area, you'll find a good topic, hopefully. Hopefully, it's been chosen, the area has been chosen broad enough not to put you into trouble, because changing the area in this school is very difficult. It happened, I know at least one case, but it is difficult, really big headache. So hopefully the area is written up broad enough so that you can pick the dissertation topic within that area easily without the need to change. So now you don't need to worry too much about it. Although as you go, maybe towards the end of your studies, you have to pick topics for your publications, for individual chapters of your dissertation, things that you want to do. And this is when the problem will become pressing. You're not going to be on your own, because your advisor will talk with you, he will help you to identify topics. But at some point, when you are independent, you get your doctorate, you go somewhere, you'll have to find topics on your own. And it's very interesting. I just reviewed a doctoral dissertation at another university in Poland. And one of the things I did is, I just out of curiosity, because I'm not an expert in the area, I don't know why they picked me, beat me, I don't know. But I wanted to check the competition, because I wanted to find out how original that question is, how original the work is. So I typed into Google Scholar the area where that person worked, and I got 20 million hits. Oh boy. I narrowed down the area, I got 18 million. I narrowed down more and more to what his dissertation is about, and I think I still was at about 20,000 papers. In my review, I honestly said I cannot judge originality of that work because I'm not an expert in this area. But I trust the other reviewers and the advisor. But boy, the competition in this area is really, really fierce. So I just trust that the student has been able to do something original in that area. This is one of the things I'm going to talk about, the competition and the question that you ask yourself when you pick topics. I think it's very, very important. What are the characteristics of an ideal research question? you don't maybe have your research questions yet. You have the area, you started work, hopefully you get involved very, very quickly and will do useful work. What are the characteristics of a research good research question? First of all, it should build on your personal preferences. So the type of work that you like doing. Is this theory? Is this implementation? Is this experimentation? What exactly is it that that you like doing? When I get a PhD student visiting for the first time, a student says, I want to work with you. Okay. After trying to persuade the student not to do PhD, and I'm doing it kind of on purpose, I want to see how strong the student is convinced that he or she wants to do a PhD. Because there are a lot of sacrifices in doing a PhD, and the question is the motivation good enough? Will the motivation stay? After that, I ask usually the question, what is it? What is the nicest project that you did in your studies so far, in your master's studies or bachelor's studies, that really that you really liked, that you enjoyed doing? And they start talking about what they did, a project, and they tell me the details. I think it's the really very important thing. What is it that you like doing? The second thing is it should build on your technical strengths. Why? Well, because if you are not strong technically in the area, you are going to have to spend time learning it. So if you already know the area, you can be productive right away. So I would say don't pick topics in for which you have to still learn a lot. There are always exceptions to what I'm saying, but ideally you should be already quite strong in it. You will not waste time. It should match your plans for after obtaining your PhD. When you finish your PhD, you go work at a university, maybe industrial research center, maybe something else. And that determines what kind of work you should do. If you want to work at a university, it doesn't matter that much. It can be theory, it can be something that is not very immediately useful. But if you plan to work in the industry, you'd better do something that is useful, that will attract their attention when you apply for jobs. They will see, oh, he already did the pipeline corrosion, right? Oh, very nice, yes? So it's not that important, but it's also something that you should look at. If you want to start a company, your own startup, high technology, you should definitely try to find a good idea, solve some problem, and that should also be the question about your plans afterwards. But the most important thing at all, more important than everything else, is when you wake up. These days, it's getting light after 5 o'clock. You open your eye, you see that it's light, maybe the sun is shining already. You don't want to turn to the other side and keep sleeping. No. You get up, get the cover off, run to the bathroom, brush your teeth, take shower, and quickly go to the lab. Why? Because the work is waiting for you, and you love it so much that that you are so impatient. You really want to work. That's really more important than anything else. Why is that? It's because you will be more productive in things that you like. You probably know it already. Things that really drive you, you spend long hours, you don't even look at the watch, and you are very productive. More productive than other people who don't like what they are doing. So this is really very important, the excitement that that you feel when you do the work. There are many, many ways that scientists were using in finding research topics, in deciding what they are going to do. I'll give you a few examples as we go. So there's not really one way, but there's no one recipe. You know, there's this Latin saying, all roads lead to Rome. When the Roman Empire was at its height, they were building roads and they were all kind of going to Rome, the central place. There's a saying in English, a proverb saying, there's more than one way to skin a cat. Sounds very not very nice, you know, skinning a cat, getting the fur of a cat. But there's more than one way to skin a cat. So there are many, many ways. There are many ways to sainthood. You know, there are many saints, as you know, probably majority of you are Catholic or Orthodox. So you know that saints have had all kinds of lives, very different. Some of them were big sinners who converted towards the end. So there are many, many roads in achieving perfection. The same with in Buddhism, you know, if you want to get to enlightenment, there are also many ways of getting that. Many roads, and you will pick your own road. So the only thing I can do is I can tell you some of the roads, how people did that. That may be inspiring. Definitely some things were inspiring for my advisor, Herb Simon, who was teaching about this. He gave several examples. So it's a hard problem. As I told you in the very beginning, becoming a scientist is a hard problem. And you can learn best from other scientists, from other people. Definitely observe your advisor, observe other people. Ask sometimes in a talk, how did you find that problem? It's such a good problem. How did you find it? They will tell you, frankly, how they found it. Because they will be very pleased you ask them. They will feel good, you know, that's such a good problem. They will tell you how they found it. So this is Herb Simon, and in his presentation on this topic, first of all, he used the word question, not problem. He said, these are scientific questions. Questions about the world. Some people call them problems, but he preferred the word question. The question doesn't have to be very specific in the beginning. You can ask a very general question. How can I make this piece of construction stronger? How can I make the concrete stronger? That's a good question in the beginning. You can become more specific later. In any case, he said that you should subject candidate questions to four basic tests. And these tests determine which questions are good, which are not good. The first question is, first test is this question solvable within the given amount of time? In your case, you have 3.5 years, maybe three even, right? The question is, can you solve that question in 3 years? And of course, in very early stages, you may not be experienced enough to make that judgment. So you will rely on the advisor. But in general, you should always ask that question, will I be able to solve it? The question may be otherwise ideal, but if you cannot solve it within a given amount of time, then it's not a good question. Once you are graduated, you have a doctorate, questions should be solvable within, I would say, a year. If questions require more than a year, you will be in trouble, because people expect from you to publish a good quality paper once a year, at least. If you don't deliver 1 year, 2 years, you are going to get into trouble. So after your doctorate, I would say the horizon is 1 year. Can I solve it in 1 year? Of course, more general question, how can I make the world better, a better place? How can I find a way to defeat cancer, for example? That's a big question. But then you start with smaller questions that you can do in a year. How does cancer react to something? In any case, important, can I solve it within the amount of time? The second question is about utility. Will anybody care about the answer? Some people pose questions that where they have to run after people and try to convince them that this is a good question. So suppose you've solved the problem, you have answered the question, you've written a paper, will people be interested in reading that? It's important from the point of view of your career, because working on interesting questions takes as much time as working on less interesting questions. But if you write about interesting questions, people will read you. imagine reading. I should get into that Journal of Improbable Research just to give you an idea. I think I should change to duplicate. And let's go and find that Journal of Improbable Research. That's, of course, a joke, that journal. What is it? What is the address of that? It's improbable.com, IG. Okay, so we go to... this... So they created this journal as a joke, but if you look at the papers, they pick existing papers and try to put that here for a joke. Usually the papers are asking questions that are not terribly interesting. So let's see. No, Ig Nobel, that's, I don't know what Ig comes from, but let's look at the 2025 ceremony. Which papers got their Nobel Prize? Winners. Look at the titles of this paper. Let's see. Literature Prize. No, that's not interesting. Let's do something in technology. Biology, chemistry, peace, engineering. Smelly Shoes, an opportunity for shoe rack redesign. Aviation, ethanol ingestion affects flight performance and echolocation in Egyptian fruit bats. Okay, it's kind of funny and interesting, but how will the world become really a better place if we know how the Egyptian fruit bats react to ethanol? Okay, kind of interesting. Dutch Courage. These are actually Dutch authors, I can see. Effects of acute alcohol consumption on self ratings and observer ratings of foreign language skills. You see that they're all funny titles, and the reason why I'm showing that is to show you that one can work on really funny, but typically not terribly useful topics. Sorry. And the amount of work you need to spend on any topic is similar. They're not terribly different. So it's very good to pick a topic that interests people, ideally, of course. A good test is if I put my paper online, will at least two people download it to read it? Sometimes questions may not have utility, and they may be discovered later and later. In 1920s, there was a British mathematician, Church. His last name was Church. He invented lambda calculus. It was a funny kind of calculus in mathematics. People didn't find it particularly useful. He was just playing. 40, 50 years later, there was a language, programming language Lisp, very important in the history of AI, artificial intelligence, that was based on lambda calculus. It was ingenious. Sometimes it happens that people make inventions that become later very important, but not about the drunken butts or drunken Dutch people perceiving other people's foreign languages. So the second question is utility. It's a good idea to pick questions that are really important. The joke. And what makes you think that there is a market for golden eggs? There is a saying in English. I don't know if it's in Polish, I don't remember. A chicken laying gold eggs, golden eggs. That's something that gives you a lot of income, a lot of benefit. Third test is, will I be the first to answer this question? As you remember, only the first person in science gets the reward in terms of publication, naming of a theorem, of algorithm. If you are the second, okay, it can be very, very smart, of course, of you, but it's going to be very hard to publish because it's been already published, it's known. So, in the important question, will I be the first? And that immediately brings to the question is, how many people are working on that? Are there any other people working on that? So, as I told you with this PhD review, where there are over 20 million people working in the area and around 20,000 publications that are relevant, the competition is too tight. In the movie that you watched last time, there was, I think it was Kretschmer, the guy from Utah, I think. He said, oh, there are so many papers on buckyballs now, it's too crowded, the area, I'm going somewhere else. That's a smart move, actually. Unless he has reasons to believe that he is going to be the first in that crowd. So it's generally a good idea to not to have too much competition. But it's a general idea if you are starting a company. It's a good idea to be one of the few, maybe the only one, offering a solution. Because then you have almost a monopoly until people get into that. You protect yourself with patents and other things, copyrights. The competition can be also from the past. You may be reinventing the wheel. But from the past you can protect yourself. You can do a literature search. If you do a good literature search, you will protect yourself from the past. You will be reasonably sure that nobody else has solved that problem. But it's also an important question, how many people are working on that problem? Are there many people? Ideally, no one, but you know, maybe a handful if it's an important problem, it's also okay. So will I be the first? And the fourth test is, do I have good tools to address this question? So why, you know, there are other people also, why am I going to be successful? I'm working hard, of course. I will solve it within the given amount of time. There's utility in this. There are some people, not too many, but why will I be the first? And a helpful question is, do I have good tools to address this question? For example, you do theoretical physics, but you don't have an accelerator. You cannot study particles. You don't have good tools. Tough. This is taken from another person. I went to a breakfast meeting of one of the professors at Carnegie Mellon, just out of curiosity. I'm a curious person. Randy Pausch. He is famous for last lecture. We will not have the time to watch it. I'll send you the link at some point, but we will talk a little about it. Randy Pausch. In the context of career planning. He offered this joke. It's really a joke. He says, what makes me think I will be successful? Because I'm smarter than others. That's a very arrogant statement to say that. I suspect that in this room, all of you have enough intelligence. You are well above 100, the average, well above it. You have enough to be successful. That's not something that distinguishes us. I wouldn't bet a dime that I'm more intelligent than any of you. I cannot say that. Hard to say, really. So when somebody says, I'm smarter than others, that's a very arrogant statement. There are people like this, but I don't think it's a very wise statement to say. There are many people that are very smart. There's scores of smart people around. And that's from Randy Pausch. You say that you are in 99th IQ percentile. Americans love to measure things, so you can say I have IQ of 144, and that's 1% of the smartest people in the world. And the joke is here: only 80 million people are smarter than you, right? You are in 1% of the smartest, but there are 8 billion people in the world, right? that means that there are 80 million still that are as smart or smarter than you. That's a big competition. So counting on being smart is not a good idea. Of course, you need to have the basic intelligence, but as I said, you all have it. That doesn't distinguish you from people in the world. Maybe people in the street, but not the scientific world. You have enough, but that doesn't make you successful yet. Too much of a competition. That's back on Simon. What makes you think that you will be successful? Because I work hard. That's a much better answer. I work hard, but everybody who wants to succeed works hard. A few years ago, I listened to an interview with Justyna Kowalczyk. She's still competing. She's still very good. But she was very successful in sports, in skiing, cross-country skiing. Her day looks as follows. She wakes up at whatever, I forgot already the details, but 7 o'clock, 7:30 or 8 o'clock, she is on the track. She exercises for 4 hours, takes a break, lunch or something, she exercises another 4 hours, 6 days a week. Really hard work, very, very hard. And that's everybody who wants to succeed, every sports person, every scientist, everybody who wants to succeed works hard. If you have your own company, you are the owner of, you have a startup, you work very hard too. So everybody who wants to succeed works hard. Of course, there are people who don't want to succeed. Who knows, maybe among you in this room, there are people who don't want to succeed. Maybe. But if you want to succeed, you'd better work hard. Because without it, it's going to be very hard. You have the intelligence, guaranteed. Working hard starts distinguishing among people. Simon's answer was, I will succeed because I have a secret weapon. Think about a war. The concept of secret weapon is, there was a miraculous weapon. Hitler had miraculous weapon, Wunderwaffe. If he proceeded and he was successful, the world would be in trouble, of course. Right? A secret weapon is something that that you have, but you don't really make it, announce it to the world. You have it only, you have the patent for it, you are the only one producing it. If there's a war, you will win the war, because you can defeat your competition, your opponents. Secret weapon. He invented it, in this context at least. I have a secret weapon. It's a much better answer. So what is that secret weapon? It's a comparative. Comparative because it's enough for me to have a better secret weapon than you, right? That's enough. In the competition, I will win because I have the secret weapon. It's just comparative, right? I have something that other people don't have. It's unfair. But who said the world is fair? The world is unfair. Some people are born very tall. If I wanted to play basketball, maybe I would be good, but I would never be very good. Darn, I was not born tall, right? If I wanted to become a jockey, a horse rider in competitions, I wouldn't be very successful. I'm too big, too heavy for that. They are usually very small. If I wanted to have children, wrong sex, right? I was born a man. The world is unfair. So you cannot really, it's not about fairness. A war is not fair. Some countries are big, some countries are smaller, right? US invaded Iran, and they are essentially doing whatever they want there. I don't think they will win, but they just do whatever they want. So this is just a comparative advantage. You have to have it over other people who are researchers. Without it, you don't have the guarantee that you will be successful. So very important. What could be a good secret weapon? A good problem that nobody has thought about before. That's a very good secret weapon. When you have a competition of 20 million people, how many of them thought about the problem that you are working on? I would think tens of thousands, maybe. At least thousands. I thought about this. Not a good problem. But if you... think about something, and you are looking for the problem not where everybody else is looking, you have the advantage. Simon's advice is, don't look for research ideas in journal articles. Some people at that time, that was 30-something years ago, there were libraries. You know what libraries are? We still have one, but not a few people use it, because we can find papers online these days. But libraries had a lot of journals printed. You could go there, get them from shelf, read from the shelf, read them, and look for ideas. Read journal articles. Simon said, don't do that. Because every month there is a new issue of a journal in your field. You can go to the library and read it, or you can download it, maybe sometimes pay for it even, and read it at home. You're wasting your time. Because most of the things, first of all, you are not going to use it. But there are other people who read that those journals also, everywhere in the world. And there are many of them, many scientists, and they are reading that. When people in the journal article write, in open problems, it would be interesting to look at this or that, that catches the attention of some people. Maybe they will work on it. So if you are going to work on it, you immediately have competition. The way Simon worked is he looked for problems elsewhere. He went to the library only when he had the problem. Once he had the problem, he went to the library to check what is known about that problem. Has this been looked at? Is there any work on it? Today there are wonderful tools for that. I haven't played with them yet, but there are AI-based or large language model-based tools where you can tell your question, research question, and they will tell you whether somebody has worked on it and what the consensus is in science. So how many people think that it's this way, or how many people think it's that way. That's a good set of tools. And then he would spend a week in the library. A week was enough to bring him up to date on this very area, this problem. And he said, after a week, I knew exactly what I wanted, what was done, and what I could do. So don't look for research ideas in journal articles. That's the advice that definitely should be is a good advice, I think. But why are you going to be the first who thinks about the problem? Maybe because the problem is based on your personal experiences. Your personal experiences, other people maybe didn't have those experiences. There will be some examples. Well, first example. Alexander Fleming, he is known for discovering of penicillin. Not our area. We are engineers. He was a biologist doing research in medicine. What happened there? He was, of course, very smart. But all of you are very smart. So that's not something that distinguished him from other people. Something that distinguished him from many people, maybe most of you, was that he was very dirty. He would just, as a matter of principle, never wash the dishes in the lab. He just dumped them in the sink. And then one day, after a month-long vacation, he came back, and he noticed that, of course, everything was moving. I don't know if there were bugs and flies flying around, but he was very curious. So he picked some samples of things from those dishes, put them under my microscope, and of course he saw many bacteria and many living things there. But one thing that he found surprising was that in those dishes that had fungi, grzyby, pleśń, mold is also part of a fungus, yes? So he noticed that where they were, there were no bacteria. It was surprising. Why not here and everywhere else, but not here? So he started studying that. Please note that, of course, he had to be very smart to notice that the bacteria were here but not there. He had to find the common thing that was distinguishing between the two things. It was the fungi that didn't have the bacteria. He started studying them, extracting substances from the fungi, and then discovered penicillin. It took him probably time to take it, but it was an interesting thing.
And the rest is, of course, history. This is a funny picture. Penicillin cures gonorrhea in 4 hours. Right? Something that people were suffering for ages. 4 hours. Very successful financially, of course. He got nobility, Nobel Prize also. Very successful scientist. And please note where he was looking for ideas. Of course, he could have read textbooks, journal articles, what people were working on. No, he just was observing things around him. It's been called one of the most influential discoveries in the history of science. That's a joke. Since Fleming already beat you to it with penicillin, I take it we can dispose of your week-old sandwich. Here's another example. Franklin was a very interesting fellow, but he wasn't a scientist, really. But he was also taking part in discussions in science. At that time, that was late 18th century, there was a discussion about the nature of thunderbolts. Some people thought maybe this is electricity, because it resembles so much things that we see in the lab. You know, they had those things to produce electricity, and they saw sparks. I thought, boy, this looks so much like the lightning in the sky during a thunderstorm. So he took part in the discussion, proposing an experiment that would definitively solve that discussion. He said, why don't we fly a kite during a storm? There's a storm coming. You fly a kite on a wire or maybe wet rope. Wet rope will conduct electricity. Put it somewhere high. Hold it with our hand and see what happens, right? Luckily, they didn't, as far as I know, they didn't conduct this experiment. But again, how did he get that idea? He was thinking back at his times when he was a child with his father. They were flying kites, and he thought, wow, that's an interesting thing. Electricity will definitely flow, find a way through least resistance, so we'll probably go on the rope. He was also very successful. I think he was one of the presidents of the United States. $100 bill is with his image. Again, almost like, you know, accidental experience. Many people fly kites, but how many thought about it this way? Simon himself is an example of that. When he was a young man, he was a student, I think college student, in Milwaukee, in Wisconsin. It's a small town. He wanted to do a practical training. And one summer, he worked for a local government. I don't remember what he was doing exactly, but he was already influenced by a little bit of economics in his school, in his college. And he noticed one funny thing. The people here in this office, they don't apply the ideas of economics. The economics says that firms maximize their profits. So if they want to make a decision, they will make a decision such that as much money as possible will come to them, as little will go out. The profits, the difference between the two. And economics was also saying about people. People maximize their utility. Utility is a measure of outcome, of value in mathematics. So people maximize their utility. For example, the economic theory says that... how many of you are married? Not many, but a few. I don't want to ask you how you found your wives, the two gentlemen. I can tell you how I found mine. But if you were conforming to the economic theory, what would you do? 8 billion people in the world. Half of that are women. Roughly, yes, 4 billion are women. Out of the 4 billion, most are too old for you when you were young. Many were too young for you. I would say out of the 8 billion, sorry, out of the 4 billion, 100 million suitable, young, pretty intelligent women you would consider to marry. If you were following the economic theory, what you should do is you should look at each one of them, study her according to different attributes, you know, intelligence, wisdom, goodness of heart, good taste in the clothing, what else? Beauty, etc. And then you should maximize, you should pick the one that gives you the highest value. I bet this is not the way you did that. Neither did I. I knew a really handful of women myself, and at some point my heart started pounding, and that was it, right? That's how it ended. So he noticed at that time that the theories coming from economics are good for the birds, but not for the people, not for the firms. Essentially, we as people don't have enough computing capability. We don't have the enough, our computer is not powerful enough to maximize, to optimize. Yes, and that's why we do something that he called himself, he used the word satisfies, satisfies, a new word. So pick the first, he described it as picking the first alternative that looks reasonable. I think in case of marriage, I think it looked more than reasonable, but first that looks reasonable. So that these were his ideas. He wanted to study it further. So when he did his doctorate at University of Chicago, he worked in the theory of organizations that interested him. And it always was in the back of his head. Later on, when he discovered there is a computer, that was 1960s, I think, first computers, he realized that there is a potential to use it to model some of the economic behavior. He wasn't an economist, he was a theoretician in the theory of organizations, but he studied using computers to model human thinking. Once he started doing that, he was one of the fathers of artificial intelligence. There were two areas in the world where artificial intelligence started. MIT, that was people like Marvin Minsky and others, and then Carnegie Mellon, he and his Simon and his student, Alan Newell, doctoral student. They started a very important branch of artificial intelligence. How did it all start? Well, he modeled humans, and he discovered that computers have something common with humans. He called it physical symbol system. And he was really one of the first, no competition. At some point, there was too much competition in artificial intelligence, I guess. There were many other people who followed, because this was an ingenious idea. He spent the rest of his life, the rest of his career on in psychology. He wasn't a psychologist, but he spent it in psychology, studying human behavior and comparing it to computers, and modeling human behavior by means of computers. Effectively, he became famous in four areas. A theory of organizations, his doctorate. He wrote a book that is still one of the key books in that area. People know him. Computer science through artificial intelligence. Then psychology. And economics found him, really. He never really thought he was an economist. They gave him a Nobel Prize for economics. But in the other areas, he got the National Medal of Honor in of science. Honor is for military people. Von Neumann Theory Prize, that's a computer science reward. Turing Award is artificial intelligence, computer science, artificial intelligence. Nobel Prize, very, very successful. And he was the one teaching how to find topics. And in fact, the history is very, very interesting. He always was curious how the economic theory, how it applies to reality. He thought that it was just not possible because of our computational power, computational abilities. Here's another example that I remember myself. I found it when I was a high school student in Lublin. I went to sometimes to lectures at the university, Skłodowska University. One of those lectures was by this guy, Bogdan Adamczyk. He was a physicist working in the area of acoustics in physics. And he was very impressed by his childhood when he was visiting his grandparents.
many of us have grandparents or had grandparents in the village. He was talking to a well, and that helped him with his stuttering yonkanya. That helped him, and he noticed that when he talked to a well, the well was responding with the echo, he didn't stutter. And that's the story he told at the lecture in 1970s when I was there. And then he started studying that, and in the area of acoustics, so acoustics and biology, and he noticed that this is a real phenomenon, that people, when they are offered their own voice with a delay, that helps with stuttering. He was very successful at that time. In 1970s, he said that there are phones that you can call in big cities, a telephone you can call, and then you get your own voice with a delay. Of course, that's an old technology. Today you would have something right in your ear, right, doing the same thing. Not even the Walkman, not even the iPods. Now you'll probably have it here. But at that time, that was the easiest available technology. You make a phone call and then you can talk to the phone, hear your own voice with a delay. I later found him in the early 2000s, just because I remember that this is a great example. So that's him with children working with that idea of echotherapy that he proposed. I would call him successful, making the world better, inventing an interesting therapy. And look where he was looking for problems. Right there. He didn't even know that he was looking for problems at that time. So he was basing this all on his personal experience. Sometimes a secret weapon can be a special instrument, a tool or a piece of knowledge that other people don't have. So you ask yourself the question, is there anything around me that other people may not have? If you look at your department and similar departments in Poland or outside, you should always think big, the world. Never think Białystok, Poland, think about the world, whatever you are doing, because you are competing with thousands of scientists all over the world. So look at what you have that other people don't have. How can you figure it out? Well, if your advisor or somebody else or your advisor is very good at something, you can look at how they did it. I visited, there is a colleague in the mechanical department who created a model of pipelines leading water from the source to different users. He constructed a model made of real pipes, PCV pipes, in order to be able to measure things and compare them to theory. That's a very nice beginning, because it took him probably months to build a model like this. So see if there is anything that is there already that can help you, that other people don't have. I'll talk more about Newton. He invented calculus. Other people didn't have it. He was solving one problem after another with his new tool before people realized what he was doing. There may be a powerful accelerator. Why most of the Nobel Prizes in theoretical physics are in Los Angeles and Pasadena, I think that's where Caltech is. Because they have a powerful accelerator, or Switzerland, CERN. Of course, you can be a good theoretical physicist, but you have much, much higher chances if you are there in Switzerland, because you have the tool that other people don't have else everywhere. So think about it carefully. Last thing is meant to be a joke. I created software in my lab. It took us a few years to create it, but then every new student had already the workbench to work on. Every new student had to contribute a little bit more than usual, writing software. They had to make sure that the software was reliable, that was good enough to be added to our software. That was the extra work. But on the other hand, if they wanted to do something, they could do it right away because the software already was ready. That's what I did locally myself. Newton. Some people accuse him of inventing calculus, but then
keeping it secret. There may be something to it. He solved problems, and in writing papers, he made it a little obscure. People couldn't really figure out what he was doing. Only when Leibniz started publishing his version of calculus, that was not as good as Newton's, Newton decided to publish the tool. He was also very successful, knighthood, and this about the apple falling on his head, that's apparently a fable, that's not a real thing. You know, the theory of gravity, the apple falling on his head. There's a quote that I will mention again when we talk about writing papers. An important quote he wrote somewhere in a letter to his friend: "If I have seen further, it is by standing on the shoulder of giants." What he meant is the following: if I was more successful, if I had produced more, it was because I was I had the work of all people who were before me. I could base on that work. So that's a very nice way of saying thank you to all the people who were scientists before him, whose work he used. Another example of secret weapon can be training in a discipline that other people are not trained in. Some of you may have very interesting backgrounds. Good examples, I don't know you that well, but one faculty member in our department in computer science is a musician. You may have been to his concert, Jacek Grekov. He has a Balkan-style group of, I think, four or five musicians and also singers. Now, he can very easily work at the area of artificial intelligence and music. What about composing music, analyzing it? He doesn't need to study music because he knows it very well. He had music training as a musician. There was a professor at Carnegie Mellon, Roger Dannenberg, who had very similar experience, a musician, and he was exactly working in the area of artificial intelligence and music. That helps also. How many people do you know who have this combination? Not too many. There are there, but not too many. Sometimes you may have first-hand experience with disease in your family, cancer, Alzheimer. That makes you know much better because you were reading. You wanted to help your parent, your grandparent. So you know much more than other people, and that provides you also the motivation to look at it carefully. You may have training in biology, art, architecture, whatever, something that is interesting, that makes you different than other people, gives you the advantage. There is a saying in English, don't put all your eggs in one basket. I don't think there is an equivalent of that in Polish, but the idea is that if you put all your eggs in one basket, you fall, you break all your eggs, right? That's not a very good situation. Yes. You cannot, don't catch too many sroka, magpie, I think, by their tails. But that's too many. This is, I would say here, don't catch only one magpie in your sroka. I don't know if it's magpie. I'm not sure about it. So here in the context of sciences, it's risky to have just one topic. It is a little risky. So as a scientist, your risk now is mitigated by the knowledge of your advisor. Your advisor will typically guide you, and the advisor has full trust that the topic that you are working on is original and it will lead to the dissertation. You can reasonably trust your advisor, I think, on that. But when you are later on your own, then it's a good idea to have a few topics, two, three, well, have 100 topics, but always work on the top three, most promising, most interesting, most promising, passing the four questions, of course, that's a good idea. So in the case of doctoral dissertation, stay focused on that thing, maybe around, be flexible, because sometimes something may not work, so then you go a little bit around it. So be flexible, but generally one direction for now. But later, have a handful of them. Another thing that is worth remembering is that there's another saying in English, chance prefers a prepared mind. Of course, things can be a matter of chance, like Fleming, the thing in the sink. But you need something more than that. You need to be prepared to see that chance. You need to be prepared to see something strange in it. So definitely open mind. I love this thing written by Mark Twain. Mark Twain was really a curious character. The man who does not read has no advantage over the man who cannot read. Think about it. Use the things that you have. Use your brain. Use the skills that you have to your advantage so that you can see opportunities. And it's also, we will mention that we should be able to talk about creativity. It can be talked about in different contexts, but it's also important for scientists to be creative. In the context of creativity, you will see that it's a very good idea to have many experiences, just many sources of things, a lot of knowledge. Our brain practically is infinite. Theoretically, of course, it's finite, but practically it's infinite. So you can learn a lot of things without paying too much price on that. I did many stupid things in my life. Probably each one of you can say the same thing about yourself. But one of the most stupid things was when I was in high school, we were with friends, we were talking, chemistry. Yeah, I don't need it. I'm not going to study that too hard. History, biology, chemistry. And then it turns out that you never know, because later on in your profession, you may suddenly realize, there are some things that are in chemistry that I should have learned better, that I should know better. So learn as many things as possible. That will make you more creative. That will make you see things also, where other people don't see it. The rest of today's presentation is just Simon's advice has finished. The four questions and secret weapon. When you find the dissertation problem, because you have the area, it was specified as an area, the exact dissertation topic, you have some flexibility there. Hopefully, a lot of flexibility. Sometimes it may happen that flexibility is less, but if your advisor wrote it correctly, he or she wrote it correctly, then it's broad enough to fit many dissertations in there. So how do you find that dissertation question? Well, definitely listen to your advisor. The advisor is one of your secret weapons. I find it very, very hard to say to my student, listen to me. There is no student of mine among you, so I cannot. I'm not afraid to say this. Listen to your advisor. Whenever I did not listen to my advisor, what happened is I spent a few months in order to realize the advisor was right. Of course, there is a non-zero chance that you are right. It's possible too. But odds, probability, are against you. Odds are against you. So it's a good idea to definitely listen carefully to your advisor, think about it, what the advisor said. If you disagree, well, say it right there in the meeting. Let the advisor defend. Let the advisor convince you. Definitely listen to the advisor. And odds are against you because the advisor has been in the area for, typically, they have a doctorate and they have also a habilitatia, which is altogether at least 10 years, I think. So they are 10 years ahead of you. That's why they may be wrong. I'm not saying that they are always right. But odds are they are right. Especially when they criticize, when they say, no, don't do that, do this. ask yourself what are the strengths of this group, department, school, university, city, country. Not a big deal to go to Warsaw to talk to somebody. Who are the people that you can rely on?
Really, don't be afraid to send an email, to call to somebody in Gdańsk, Wrocław, Warsaw, whatever, and ask, can I would like to talk to you. I would like to ask you a few questions and talk to people.
Definitely when they are here, absolutely do that. Doctoral dissertation is just a progress report. What does it mean?
Sometimes people think about it as this is my lifetime project. It has to be perfect. Sometimes it happens this way and people are successful, but again, it's not a typical way. If you have seen a movie, Beautiful Mind, Piękny Umysł in Polish, it's about, it's a real story, a scientist, an economist, John Nash. He is famous for a theorem concerning equilibrium. Equilibrium is called today in his honor Nash equilibrium. He has gotten also Nobel Prize for that work. In the movie it is shown that he is walking around for 1 or 2 years. He was schizophrenic, so he was doing all kinds of funny things also. But he was walking around the university looking for the lifetime topic. And he was successful. Once he found it, he solved it, he was successful. But it's not a very good, it's a very risky way.
So don't think about it this like this. Get a few good questions, good topics, a few good quality papers, make out of them a dissertation, and it's okay to have some problems open, left for later years when you are done with your doctorate.
At some point you write it up,
frankly say what hasn't been done yet, what are interesting future pieces of work that you will do, but it's a progress report. Every paper is also a progress report, not typically doesn't solve all the problems in the world. You should play actively with knowledge that you are gaining, always having this questioning attitude, why? Be critical, ask questions always. Being critical is a good idea for a scientist. It's sometimes so interesting, I noticed that, maybe not in science that much, but I noticed that sometimes talking to colleagues, to friends, to some family relatives, you must have noticed what happens in the political discussions in Poland. People are often just flatly refusing to talk about things. And that's a tragedy. That's a very unscientific approach. You cannot just do science yourself without being exposed to critique. You should talk, and you should always ask yourself, is it really so? Scientific knowledge is always tentative. It's always temporary. The smallest experiment can change things. So scientists, ordinary people should talk to each other. At least to establish facts. You can have your own opinions, but you cannot have your own facts. Facts has to be established. So we should talk. We cannot just say, okay, we cannot talk because you are such a hard-headed pisher or lemming, right? We cannot do that. We should talk. But in science, absolutely, you should talk. And it's okay to disagree. When somebody tells you something in a talk, of course you don't say to that person, oh, that's bullshit. You don't do that, but you ask questions. You said that this and this, but I read it in the paper by Jones that it was the other way. What do you think about it? Why is the difference? Let them explain. Let them tell why. Yes. So always don't believe things. Always question. Such questioning is not a good idea in personal life. You are with your husband or your wife, and every time your husband says something, you always kind of put it into doubt, yes? Or the other way. Not a good idea, probably. But in case of science, absolutely. Absolutely. Because we are in the business of improving our knowledge of the world. So don't hesitate to ask,
very politely, very nicely, but ask.
And also, when you learn something and it's in conflict with what you knew so far, either you were wrong or that thing is wrong. I'll find out. Take practical problems. The best ideas come from practical problems, because it's a practical problem. You kind of want to solve it. You are not working in some domain of science fiction, but science, practical things are really good. Be careful who you are listening to. That's another advice that I give, because people have so many opinions, and among your colleagues, probably doctoral students, they may have different opinions. It's okay to listen, but there are many things that are just not true. Be careful who you are listening to and what they are saying, and make a judgment yourself. Think, and once again think. That's a very important thing. This is what we are doing best, thinking. And also, when you have ideas, talk about them. Test them. Talk to your spouse, to your boyfriend, girlfriend, friends, to your parents, to your advisor, to other faculty. Tell them, what do you think about this? That's very important in business, when you have a startup company and you are doing business, it's a good idea to talk to people, to kind of test it. What do they think about it? In science, it's also definitely a very good idea. Creativity is very important, I think, for everybody. And finding a topic, creativity helps definitely very much. Finding a topic, finding a solution to a question. It's nice. It's not complete, the quote from Einstein. He said something like, knowledge tells us what we have already seen, what we know, but imagination will show us things that we have not yet learned. Last year it was lost because of Godzina Rektorstia. The rector decided that it's off free. Who knows, maybe it will happen in May, but hopefully not. Maybe Wednesday is a safe day. Motivation and commitment. It's very important. Remember, this working hard is really a very... it's a necessary thing, essentially. Usually you work around 80 hours a week for 10 or so years to become an expert. There has been work in so-called psychology of expertise. I was exposed to psychology in my doctoral studies, and I loved it. Psychology because I worked at the intersection of artificial intelligence and decision support, so I needed to know a little bit about humans. So psychology was fascinating, really. Still is fascinating. But there's also a branch of psychology, cognitive psychology, that focuses on expertise. And there are probably, I would say, probably thousands of papers on the topics related to how people become experts. And some of the findings there are interesting. All the people who have been very successful were workaholics. So Einstein was a workaholic, Mozart and Justyna Kowalczyk, and across disciplines, the same thing. They work very hard. Workaholics, and it takes them about 10 years to become experts. 10 years, 80 hours a week, roughly. Sounds, of course, terrible, 80 hours, but I mean, I count not just sitting at your desk 80 hours, because that's very hard, but, you know, you take shower, you think about your problem. You ride your bicycle to school, you think about your problems. When I think about it, I definitely work that many hours. I work 6 hours, 6 days a week, typically from 8 to 5, and then in the evening a few more hours, and then Saturday maybe a little longer. Sometimes when I have deadlines, I worked longer. I pulled out an all-nighter sometimes. So you have to do it, and you have to find that time, essentially. Well, think if you want to do it. If there are many ways,
many things that people can do in life, in their career, in their life, and there's really not one ideal way of life. It's really not. Think about what your career looks like, will look like as a scientist, and then if you decide to do it, do it. Put everything in. Be enthusiastic about what you are doing. That makes everything fun and easy. And, well, you cannot force yourself to be enthusiastic, I guess. So, well, give it a good try. If you cannot become enthusiastic, then it's going to be tough, because other people who are enthusiastic, who are working long hours, will be getting ahead of you. And that's a frustrating experience, that you are a scientist, but not that competitive. Interacting with other people. Just like I told you in the very beginning of this course, it's important to interact with other people because you learn a lot. Advisor, colleagues, people who are in your area, you should go to conferences, workshops, symposia, and talk to people. Definitely. Not about football, which is also interesting, but about their work. Professors in related areas, friends and family, about your work. You never know what interesting things you'll hear from them. Important thing is some people like talking, but not listening. So you have to also listen. It's a much more difficult skill than talking, but listening is very critical because you can get feedback from people and learn useful things. Skills are important. So like, you know, the things... this seminar just points out the things that you should know, should learn. But you should work on them. You will not learn all these skills in just one seminar of 20 hours. That's very hard. So reading quickly is a good idea. Learning to read quickly. Writing is important. Mentor, not necessarily your advisor, but people you can talk about as being mentors in different areas, different aspects of your work. Get involved in research. So don't wait until things will start doing by themselves, but start doing research. I assume you are already. It's the end of your first year. And doing them things for real. So an advisor may give you sometimes a paper to review, to ask for help with organizing a conference or teaching a class for him or her when the advisor is out of town. Do it, because you will learn with that. Simple tricks that are kind of nicely fitting into this talk. Having friends is a good idea, balancing them out. So different areas. Simon would in that talk, he would say that he goes to have lunch once a week with somebody from a different department. So how does he know them? Well, he knows them because they meet in maybe university level meetings. He would chat to them. Oh, you are an anthropologist. Why don't we have lunch together next week? And then he would ask question: what's new in your field? What are people excited about these days? Then the friend would tell him something. And then if he noticed that there is something that he could relate to his work, that he has something to say about. Then he would follow this lunch up with an email asking, can you recommend me a good overview paper on this topic? And of course they would send him the paper. And then he would spend a week in the library, read the paper, spend a week in the library to crystallize his idea, and that was the beginning of a paper, a new paper, essentially. New idea where he would have something to say about the problem. The boundaries between disciplines, I mentioned that already, that I think it's a temporary thing, and it's just in Poland, I think, maybe in some other countries too, but not that I know of them. This idea that if you are a computer scientist, you should publish in computer science journals. If you are a mechanical engineer, mechanical engineering. I think that idea has turned back the clock of Polish science, definitely by years. It happened in, I think, around 2016, 17, if I'm not mistaken, that every scientist has to publish in his or her area. That's a ridiculous idea, and that will be over once people start seriously treating science. Because the most fertile areas for topics, for questions, are exactly at the intersection of areas. That's the most fertile. Because these people don't see it, you will see it. So you look around your area. If the current rule imposed by the Ministry of Education, Science and Education in Poland, if this rule was there, computer science would never come to being, neither mechanical engineering, civil engineering, because if you look at the Middle Ages, there were just four departments, I think. Philosophy, theology, maybe natural sciences, and I forgot what the fourth one, maybe literature or something. That's it. So only when people realize there is something in between or something inside, they started creating new disciplines. We will talk about time and stress, so we will definitely come back to the idea of structuring the time, having a diary. Okay, I told you to listen to your advisor, so it's a good idea in general, but listen always critically. So listen to the advisor. If you have other ideas, if you disagree, say it. Have a discussion, fight it out, and say it. If you are still not convinced, go and do a little bit of reading, try to get to the bottom of things. So don't give up easily. You cannot, as a scientist, you cannot just believe what people are saying. You have to always check it against your knowledge so far. The king is naked fable, you know it, it's also in Polish, that's Andersen, I think. Emperor's New Clothes is the title of that fairy tale, you probably know it. You know it, right? Who doesn't know it? You don't know it. You know it. Okay. Everyone knows it. When you talk to people about your ideas, some people are very protective. They keep the cards close to the medals, as they say. I don't think it's a good idea, because what are the benefits of not telling other people your ideas? Well, they are safe. They will not be able to steal the ideas from you. That's the only benefit that I can think of. What are the bad things about not sharing ideas? You don't get feedback. People will not tell you what they think about it. They will not be able to correct you, to straighten you out. So it's a good idea to share your ideas. But you have to be careful, with that. When you are at a conference and you don't know somebody, don't tell them the nicest, the best ideas you have that you haven't worked out yet. Because they are in the same conference, they are maybe in the same field, they are looking for topics, every scientist looks for topics. They may have the temptation of stealing your ideas. But when you talk to your advisor, to your colleagues in the lab, to other people in the university, it's okay. If they steal, you take a sztachetka. What is that in English? I don't know. Go and beat them up. Yes. So that's the approach I use. I'm careful with people that I don't know completely. I had at least two times a case where somebody kind of assimilated my idea. One time it was that person was a reviewer. We managed to solve it actually. I was happy with the solution. So it can happen. But if I know somebody, I'm quite open with what I do. So it's okay, because I can learn something when talking to people.
Maybe I'm wrong, so I want to know it. Play with the knowledge, expose yourself to ideas. So learn many things. Go to a theater, watch a movie, read a book. These are all things that influence your creativity. We will talk about it in the context of time management and stress, setting aside large chunks of time for thinking. This is something that we do as scientists.
That's what distinguishes us from people in business, where they are disturbed by phones, they have meetings, they have to run from one place to another. Scientists can sit down and sit for a few hours thinking and working on something. And that's exactly when the best ideas come, when you have undisturbed long chunks of time.
We'll come back to that later. And then you learn all your life. You develop yourself. The next thing that we are going to talk about, next week is Friday, you remember, yes?
It's a Wednesday, but at the university it's a Friday, after Easter. So we are meeting in 2 weeks from now. When we meet, we will talk about career planning. That's an interesting thing. I'm going to send you a link to, actually two links to two videos. One of them is quite hard to follow. Let me check if I can put it on YouTube in my private channel, and YouTube may generate this subtitling. That will make it easier, because the quality of the recording is not so good. The guy doesn't speak terribly clearly, but he is talking about really very, very useful, very important things. The second is a lecture by Randy Pausch. I mentioned him today. That one has subtitles, Polish and English, so you can listen to it. It's also a very good movie to watch. Both of them are about, each of them is about an hour. Definitely worth looking at, and the whole meeting is going to be devoted to career planning. How do you plan your career? And it's not about changing your profession, no. Within the profession that you are now, how do you strategically plan your career, for the future of your career, which means from now until you are 60, 70 or 80. Scientists often decide to work longer than 60, 65. I guess that's it. So thank you very much. Do you have any questions? No, so I'm turn it off.